From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, we mark Sexual Assault Awareness Month by getting an update on the Regents University's new sexual assault policies. First, we'll talk with a young woman who was sexually assaulted while a student at Des Moines Area Community College. Then we'll find out how such cases are handled on campuses and what's being done in terms of prevention. My guests will include John Boozy, Assistant Dean of Students at UNI, Lieutenant Aaron DeLashmut, who oversees the Criminal Investigations Unit of the ISU Police Division, and Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victims Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. An update on sexual assault and the prevention of it on Iowa campuses. First, this news update. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and that's why we want to take this hour to get an update on the problem of sexual assault on Iowa's campuses. And then, later in the hour, a closer look at what's being done to prevent sexual assaults. The problem of sexual assault is a perennial one for college campuses. Despite years of public education and policy, 1 in 5 college women will be the victim of rape or attempted rape before graduation. But that number, from a national study funded by the Justice Department, we'll hear more about that in a few minutes, is at best an estimate, since sexual assault remains underreported, both by victims and by colleges. And the students who do report attacks face a depressing litany of barriers that often either assure their silence or leave them feeling victimized for a second time. That's a conclusion of a 9-month investigation released by the Center for Public Integrity. We'll talk about that a bit later, but we start this hour with a young woman who was sexually assaulted while a student at Des Moines Area Community College in April of 2008. While the assault did not happen on campus, it is typical of the sexual assaults that do happen on campus. Shannon joins us this afternoon by phone. Good afternoon, Shannon.
Afternoon.
Thanks for joining us, and especially thank you for having the courage to step forward and to share your story in the hopes of bringing more awareness to the problem of sexual assault. This happened in 2008 at a party for your 21st birthday. What can you tell us about the circumstances?
I had a friend of mine throw me a party for my 21st birthday, and we wanted it to kind of be safe, and so we had it at the house, and everybody was staying the night and stuff, and I just invited mostly my siblings and their spouses and my sister's brother-in-law and his wife. For the most part, that's all that came. And we drank throughout the night and, like, had meal and cake and stuff. And at 11:30 that night, I went to bed in my nephew's room, and everybody else continued to go about whatever they were doing, listening to music and things like that. And shortly after I went to bed, I awoke to my brother and or my sister's brother-in-law assaulting me, and a lot of his claims was I was drinking, and I said no several times and tried to push him away, but it didn't work, and that continued on for a little over an hour. And then...
Was no one else in the house aware of this?
No. Nope. Mm-hmm. He had gone, it's kind of connected, you have to go through the bathroom to get to the bedroom. So he had gone into the bathroom and locked the door, and so nobody could really get to the bedroom. And the music was playing really loud, so we could really hear anything.
What did you do after the assault?
I waited a little bit because I didn't know quite how to handle it because it was somebody I knew, and I was kind of shocked, and like, this was someone I trusted, and he was like a brother to me, and I didn't know where to go or how to even tell anybody. And about halfway through the night, I got up to try to find my cell phone, and everybody was sleeping, and I went back. I couldn't find my cell phone. I didn't have a car there to leave. I went back to the room and locked myself in the bedroom and waited till morning, and then finally found my cell phone and called my mom.
Mm-hmm.
She took me to...
What action was taken then?
We went to the hospital, and they sent me to Planned Parenthood, where we had a rape kit done, and filed a police report. And then that kind of led into a whole set of events. There was a lot of, you were both drinking, could have been consensual, and kind of hard to report it and things like that.
So the assailant, this case ended up in court?
The day before it was supposed to go to court, he took a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
It actually took 18 months before it got that far, but it took 3 or 4 months. They finally got him to take a lie detector test, which he failed, and so they charged him, and then they had depositions and things to do, and we had several court dates set, but then the prosecution finally said, no, this is not the following September, the September after. He said, this is the court date. We did the pretrial preparation and everything, and then less than 24 hours before, he took a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm. It's been 2 years since the assault. What do you take away from this now? How have your feelings changed about the assault, and what lessons have you drawn from it?
The biggest one is to talk about it. I didn't say, I reported it, and then I kept myself for 6 months and didn't talk. I saw a therapist, but I didn't talk to her. I didn't share it. After 6 months, there was kind of, I had got the subpoena for the deposition and things, and I felt completely alone. I felt like there was that no one, I had no support and no one to back me up, and I overdosed and ended up in the ICU, and then after that, I got involved with Access and started talking, and the biggest thing I learned is the more I talked, the better I felt, the more I didn't feel alone, and I just had that 2-year anniversary, and it's still hard, but it's a lot easier when you have someone there to, mm-hmm. Cry with you and talk to you and tell you that you did the right thing and that you were not.
It must be a difficult step to come on the radio and talk about it, and we want to thank you again for doing that. And your motivation for telling us your story is?
I just want people to know that it happens, and just because there's alcohol involved doesn't mean that it's consensual. Doesn't mean that, if you say no, you say no. And just so that college students, because I think that ends up happening a lot in college, and it doesn't go reported because they don't feel like anybody would believe them. So it was just more to bring awareness and to help college students kind of speak up.
What thoughts do you have about the key to preventing sexual assaults? It seems that because this is someone you knew and trusted, that may be something we can help in terms of prevention is to be aware of the people you know, because it's not necessarily the stranger jumping out of an alley.
Yeah, more times than not, it's somebody you know, somebody that you would trust. And I think you have to be kind of cautious of your surroundings, and don't be paranoid, but just kind of watch, have somebody with you, kind of have a buddy system, that they will check on you. And I think that I'm not sure. Mostly with prevention is I think that the more it's talked about, and the reason I think the more you talk about it, I think is better, because I think that perpetrators tend to think that they know it's hushed upon and that the victim won't speak out because they're afraid or embarrassed or, and I think that if people spoke out more, the perpetrators would be afraid. That would be a thought in their head that, more than likely I'm going to get in trouble for this, where now they think that nobody will ever say anything.
Have you been treated well during this process by law enforcement in the course of justice, or according to this report, some feel we're left feeling victimized a second time? Do you have any sense that you feel victimized by the process after you came forward?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I will say that the prosecutor I had and the police officers and stuff, I worked with one detective and then the prosecutor mostly, but they were extremely nice and very caring and answered questions. And so I don't want it to sound like they didn't make me feel at ease. But just the fact that you don't have any rights, and anything about you can be brought into court, but nothing about them can be brought into court, and just feeling like you're the one on trial. And I think that kind of needs to change, and there should be a speedier process so it's not dragged out for 18 months of it hanging over your head. And you have to tell your story over and over again, and that's a little, that's, yeah, victimizing would be a good word. You just feel like you never get ahead of it. You can't move on until it's over, and it feels like it takes forever to be over. So,
Shannon, we want to wish you well, and thank you again for sharing this horrible experience with us so that others may be aware of it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Shannon, a young woman who was sexually assaulted while a student at Des Moines Area Community College in April of 2008. And while this assault did not happen on the campus, we're going to turn to Carla Miller now, joining me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Executive Director of the Rape Victims Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Carla, we have about a minute before we need to take a short break. How similar is her case to that is found on college campuses?
I think she did a good job of highlighting a lot of the issues that come up and that a lot of cases and victims have in common. And, and that is that you don't expect somebody that you know to attack you, and you don't know what to do about it. And you have, people have to struggle, or they often struggle with feeling like somehow it was their fault, or feeling that they gave some magic signal or something, and in other words, they oftentimes victims will blame themselves and not know why, what they did wrong. And the reason is they didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. And they keep searching for the question of what they did wrong. And
exactly. And mm-hmm. And they'll never find that by looking at themselves. They'll find that who did something wrong by looking at offenders.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back as we update our look at sexual assault on Iowa campuses. Carla Miller with us, Executive Director of the Rape Victims Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Other guests joining us as well. Have you been a victim? You can tell us your story this hour. What do you think is the key to preventing sexual assault? A matter of taking more precautions or changing campus culture? Perhaps both. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. And we're back with Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa, this hour talking about sexual assault on Iowa campuses. And Carla, before we introduce another guest here, you have often referred before the show to a study done about sexual assault on campus by the Center for Public Integrity. What were the key findings, of that recently completed study?
Well, I think the key findings are ones that are common on probably all campuses, but looking at the problem of repeat offenders, also a lack of consequences from sexual assault for the offenders, confusion about how to handle these cases, also in looking at the enforcement of Title IX. In assault cases. So the findings that probably are the most concise is that victims across the board felt they weren't listened to in most cases. Also there are other things, but.
Okay. Let's open our conversation to John Boozy, Assistant Dean of Students at the University of Northern Iowa in our studios in Cedar Falls. So good afternoon to you, John Boozy.
Good afternoon.
Walk us through the judicial and the disciplinary process that takes place when a sexual assault involving a student is reported.
At the University of Northern Iowa, we adjudicate sexual assault complaints through a committee we call our Student Conduct Committee, which is actually a committee of faculty, staff, and students who hear more serious cases of misconduct. And the vast majority of cases that they hear relate to sexual misconduct. In a situation where we have an allegation of sexual misconduct, a panel of five members of that committee will actually conduct the hearing and hear testimony from both the person bringing the concern as well as the individual being accused. They'll certainly entertain and consider evidence brought by those parties as well as other evidence and witnesses that they may present as well. The committees are charged with making a determination first as to whether or not the university policy on sexual misconduct has been violated. If they make that conclusion, then they would determine the appropriate sanctions, which can range in a number of areas, but typically center on suspension or expulsion from the university.
Now, sexual assault, rape is vastly unreported. What steps are taken to make sure that the student victims stay safe after reporting?
Well, I think immediately our protocols at UNI encourage reporting directly to an advocate and getting students first and foremost to a trained sexual assault advocate who can both provide immediate assistance relative to getting medical exams, ensuring safe housing, the things that would be in the close aftermath of an incident. In terms of our policy, we do things relative to what I would describe as our Good Samaritan provision, which we implemented a number of years ago to help respond to concerns about, and I think Shannon sort of described this a little bit in her story, about use of alcohol, for example. So what the Good Samaritan provision says is if a student who's been victimized or a witness who is providing information in good faith that would help us adjudicate a sexual assault complaint, that person who's reporting will not be held responsible for example, underage drinking as a result. I think that helps to facilitate reporting. In addition, we can take steps to protect victims just immediately by issuing no contact orders, barring the accused from access to a person's residence hall. If we need to move a victim to another residence hall or alternate housing, we have protocols in which to do that. Even during the hearing, we have the ability to separate the parties. So sometimes victims may prefer to participate from another room where they don't have to actually sit near the person they're accusing. Things like that help create a more comfortable environment. I think we also believe that a coordinated institutional response is really critical to making sure that we are all aware of what is happening relative to a student who's brought a concern.
John Boozy is Assistant Dean of Students at the University of Northern Iowa. Let's turn now to Lieutenant Aaron DeLashmut. He is in our Ames studio, oversees criminal investigations unit at the Iowa State University Police Division. Good afternoon to you, Lieutenant DeLashmut.
Good afternoon.
Having listened to what John Boozy just described there, you take how is your response and investigation at ISU perhaps different? I know you sort of integrated with the community in the way you respond to reported sexual assaults, aren't you?
Yeah, that's correct. We've established kind of a community response to these types of incidences. Our Story County Sexual Assault Response Team, that was set up about 10 years ago, and that's set up. The main purpose of that is to put the victim first, you know, as listening to the victim. And as other people know, it's a difficult process to go through. So we don't want to force them into a process that they're not ready to go through. So we'll walk through them with them through that and make sure that they're ready to proceed however they want. And, you know, we help them find services that would help them, you know, whether that's through advocacy, medical, law enforcement, or services through the university as well.
And we heard, too, from Shannon as well, and we hear from, you know, the evidence here that assailants use the fact that they know a lot of these will not be reported as a way to perhaps get out of responsibility for that act. If getting more reports is the key, what have you discovered, Lieutenant DeLashmut, about getting more people to come forward with this and not in lessening the repercussions that someone might have the second hand, the second victimization, so to speak.
Right. I think, you know, what I've noticed in my time here is that just general awareness is a big factor in this, not only for the victims, but for the community as well. You know, as the victim described today, that court process is very difficult to go through. And there may be different ways for that to be set up, so it's not as difficult. So, you know, if a community had a better understanding of what that's like, what they're feeling, those things might start to take place. They might start to change. And also, you know, just letting the general public aware that these things can happen so that if they're at a party and they notice somebody kind of being rough with somebody else or taking advantage of somebody's situation, that maybe they'll step up and stop it before it becomes a problem.
John Boozy of the University of Northern Iowa, I understand that the UNI has a consent-based policy versus a force-based policy. What is the difference?
Well, the essential difference, I think, in layman's terms is that it essentially affirmative consent is the way I would describe it, moves a conversation from no means no to yes means yes. That is that the initiator of any sexual activity has to have clear verbal consent or nonverbal consent through clear action. So what that means, I think, in practice is that if a student is accused of violating that policy, they'll have to answer an essential question, which is, what did you do to ensure that you had the verbal consent or clear nonverbal consent of the other party, rather than blaming the victim for what they did or what they did not to become a victim, if that makes sense. So I think the essence of consent is that it moves it from having to show that you force someone into sexual activity to demonstrating that you had their consent to engage in sexual activity.
Carla Miller, tell us, should have started out with this, how prevalent is sexual assault on Iowa's campuses? The University of Iowa is where you're most acquainted, I know, but what can you tell us about the prevalence and the trends here?
Well, I think that certainly the one in four to one in five women are estimated to be victims of sexual assault during their college career. And I, you know, how that breaks down is that only about 1 out of 10 are estimated to be reported, and that may be even lower because oftentimes it's somebody that they know. We had in the first three quarters of this year 59 rapes reported to us.
At the University of Iowa?
At the University of – well, actually in total, about 22 of those were at the University of Iowa.
Okay, and the guess that we have no real way of knowing, but how small is that tip of the iceberg, would you say? 20%, 30%, more than that?
It would probably be around 60, 70, I would guess.
60 or 70 that have been reported or non-reported?
Not reported.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Anywhere from 70 to 85%.
Non-reported. We will come back and continue our update on sexual assault on Iowa's campuses. Carla Miller with us, John Boozy of UNI with us, and I want to thank you. I know you have to go away. Lieutenant DeLashman, thank you for joining us from the studio in Ames.
No problem. Thanks for the time.
And we'd like to have you join our conversation. Have you been a victim? Tell us your story. What do you think is the key to preventing sexual assault on campuses? A matter of taking more precautions or changing campus culture? 1-866-780-9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our conversation continues in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and that's why we're looking at that as an update on Iowa's campuses, where we are, how we are in terms of prevention programs. The problem of sexual assault is a perennial one for college campuses. Despite years of public education and policy, one in five college women will be the victim of rape or attempted rape before graduation. And this half hour, we've been talking with Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Now also joining us, Monique DiCarlo. She's in a newly created position at the University of Iowa, a Sexual Misconduct Response Coordinator. Good afternoon to you, Monique.
Thank you.
Tell us very quickly about your new position, which has only existed how long?
formally about a year. I did serve in the position for on an interim basis for about 6 months before that. The primary function of the role is to serve as a coordinating contact point when complaints of sexual misconduct come forward in the, on campus. And my responsibility is to ensure that victims or those reporting the information have both resources and knowledge about what their reporting options are.
Mm-hmm. There were revisions in the Regents University's approach to sexual misconduct. What prompted that?
Well, I think one of the things that allowed us to do a region-wide revision of the policy was that there was a grant from the Department of Justice, the Office on Violence Against Women, a flagship grant led by Dr. Annette Lynch, that allowed all Regent campuses to work together to revise their sexual misconduct policies. On our campus, we had specifically had some challenges in responding to a student who was sexually assaulted, and there were concerns that the Regents were had about how we responded to that situation, as well as various offices on campus also concerned about that.
Dr. Lynch is joining us as well. Annette Lynch, University of Northern Iowa professor, also flagship director of the Campus Violence Prevention Project. She oversees this big grant for all of the three Regents universities. Good afternoon to you, Annette Lynch.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. So tell us more about what this program has done so far at the three Regents universities to help prevent sexual assaults.
The purpose of the flagship grant was to take some of the successes that you and I had had from 2000 to 2004 with two individual campus grants from the Department of Justice and to implement some of those programs on the other two campuses. I think with the revision of the sexual misconduct policies as a platform, we've been able to build prevention programs on top of that so that we have not only a good system for dealing with students that experience sexual assault, but also a series of prevention programs that are meant to transform the campuses into safer places for all students to live. The foundation of many of those prevention programs is the bystander approach. And the bystander approach really focuses on the campus as a whole, as young men and young women who can play active roles as peers. So if they are at a party and they're aware that one of their friends or one of their acquaintances is either in danger of being assaulted or is in the process of, for example, trying to get a young woman drunk in order to commit a sexual assault, that they step in and play an active role in trying to transform that party culture, that campus culture, into a safer place for all students to live.
How is that communicated in this bystander education program? In what form do we get it to students to say, as a bystander, you also have a responsibility, more than anything, a responsibility not to let things go and to speak up when things do go too far?
Two programs that I think have been really effective in Iowa are the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program and the Forum Acting Program. And the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program actually dates back 10 years. I was directing women's studies at that point, and I wanted to begin to not just have Take Back the Night rallies with people already sort of involved in this issue, but to work with athletic programs. We work with Greek programs. So I sponsored a national training, which Monique DiCarlo, who's on this show, was at, and 30 people from the three Regents schools. And that training trained us in a bystander approach that focuses on young men as well as young women, and again, not focusing on men as perpetrators or potential perpetrators, but as empowered bystanders who can confront abusive peers. And so it's a interactive discussion and training that really pulls these young men into roles where they begin to practice how to work in social settings to decrease violence against women. The other program that I think has been really successful is an interactive forum theater program. We started Save Forum Actors, the Students Against a Violent Environment, here at UNI, and with our first grant in 2000 to 2002. Our troupe was led by a very wonderful woman named Karen Mitchell, and Again, what the Forum Acting Group does is provide scenarios which student audience members watch, and at a point where a sexual assault may likely happen, the audience members are actually invited into the Forum Acting experience to come up with solutions, to talk to the actors about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that program has also been implemented now at Iowa State University and at the University of Iowa. And in fact, Iowa State troop just won the Outstanding Program of the Year award from Bacchus Peer Education Network this year for their new acting troupe. So those two bystander approaches, I think, have been very effective on all three state university campuses and have been funded by the Flagship Initiative.
Talking about sexual assault on Iowa's campuses, also the prevention of it this hour, if you've been a victim, tell us your story. What do you think is the key to preventing sexual assault? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Annette Lynch of UNI with us, Monique DiCarlo, and Carla Miller of the University of Iowa. Let's go to Abby in Cedar Falls. Hi, Abby. Abby, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us. What comes to mind when you hear this conversation?
I just really enjoy this. I am taking a class right now at UNI on violence and intimate relationships. And so we've learned a lot about these issues, and I'm glad that the bystander education model was just talked about. I think that's one of the most important things, too. So it kind of men and women are both able to speak up, and sometimes people don't know what to do when they're in that situation. So the more knowledge and awareness that is out there and the resources that they have, they're going to be more likely to speak up and to intervene when things are happening to people that they know.
Mm-hmm. So explain specifically what you've learned about how a bystander could speak up, for instance, what they can say.
Things that they can do. They can either go to that person directly. They can say something later on to it. They can go talk to someone else from an organization. There's a lot of things that they can do, but just being really knowledgeable about the resources, and, you know, they can give someone a number to the local domestic violence agency that they have, or, you know, just talk about signs and see how that relationship is going with them, making sure they don't, you know, go home with them if they're out at the bars at the campuses. There's a lot of ways that someone can intervene.
Do you notice, away from when you're participating in this program, that any noticeable effect on the campus culture that you can discern?
Not any noticeable thing. I think that it's really good having kind of like the buddy system. When people go out, they know who they're there with. When I took this class, I didn't really know much about it, but through the Sexual Assault Awareness Month, there's been a lot of different events on campus, and I think that the awareness is there. We actually were encouraged to bring some males to a forum for class, and I think that's important to bring the men into it. I mean, the more that we all know, the better it is. A lot of times women are the ones that are at the little gatherings, you know, talking about sexual abuse and sexual assault. And so having the men involved has really helped. And I think that they're becoming more aware of the issue on campuses.
Abby, thank you for giving us a ring today. Abby calling from Cedar Falls. Thank you very much. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. So, Monique DiCarlo, this seems to be a real change in culture here, that an important change that men are in on this too, on the solution, and not just seen as potential perpetrators.
I think it's important. It's key for all of us to understand that we have a role and a responsibility as a community member, and to believe that we can make change in preventing and eliminating these types of issues from occurring in our community and worldwide. And I think sometimes it can be overwhelming, or we look at all of the aspects that contribute to attitudes and beliefs that violence in women's lives or anyone's lives is acceptable, mm-hmm. and sometimes get overwhelmed with that. And it's important to remember that each one of us, regardless of what our title is or education or background, we all have an opportunity to make a difference in preventing.
When you think about the enormity of the cultural norm that we are changing, it's really quite large, isn't it, Carla Miller? I'm thinking about, just the other day I was watching, you know, I like to watch 1950s, 1960s films, mm-hmm. and there you see the treatment, the relationship between men and women portrayed with a lot of these signs in here, where a woman may say no, but she's being coy. Mm-hmm. And actually the no means yes, and that's very clearly communicated to the viewer. So a lot of culture here that we're having to change.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that one of the two of the most challenging things that we have to deal with is victim blaming. We ask them to serve as witnesses for us so that we can get dangerous people sequestered from everybody else. And yet there's a lot of victim blaming. There's a lot of perpetuation of myths and things like that.
Victim blaming in terms of, well, you shouldn't have worn that dress or you shouldn't have acted like that at the party.
That's right.
And unless you wanted something to happen.
Well, and yeah, it's like if a guy spends a lot of money on a woman, then she's expected to have sex at the end. I mean, there's a lot of sexual stereotyping that really sets up a rape culture, a culture in which it's a high risk. I think that the other thing that victims have to see before they'll come forward are consequences. So they need to see support, not be blamed, and they need to see consequences to the offender.
I think that's why an affirmative consent policy is so important, and understanding that it's not about just no means no, but it means that if there's not no, it doesn't mean it's yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different way of thinking about sex and sexuality, and it should inform the way in which we're educating not only our college students on campuses, but all of us about preventing sexual assault.
Monique DiCarlo is the Sexual Misconduct Response Coordinator at the University of Iowa. Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Annette Lynch, I want to turn to you at the University of Northern Iowa and ask about another program we haven't touched on, Mentors in Violence Prevention. This one is aimed at student athletes specifically. Tell us about it.
The Mentors in Violence Prevention program, while it started out definitely a program associated with athletics, is actually a program that has expanded on our three campuses and is used with the more general student population, and it's used with men as well as women. One of the more exciting things that I think is happening on the campuses is it's being infused not only into programming, but also courses on campus. And so we did have a UNI student speaking earlier on the show that talked about the fact she was learning about this in her class. And we had our gender violence prevention task force meeting with all three campuses yesterday, and I was so excited to hear about the infusion of the MVP program into courses. It, again, is a bystander approach. It's a leadership model. It was founded and created by Jackson Katz, who has been a frequent speaker on our three campuses. And again, the point with the MVP approach is to find leaders within your community, which is why it sort of started out with athletes, because athletes are often looked up to on campuses. But find leadership in any student group and train those leaders to be good bystanders and stand up for the right things. Because if the people in your peer group are going to present good models of having positive relationships, of standing up for the right thing at parties, those people are going to influence other people. And so you try to find leaders within the Greek community, leaders within the athletic teams, and train those male and female students to be good bystanders in their social context.
Not only have the student-athletes are looked up to role models, but we've had several high-profile cases involving student-athletes, too. Also a reason for this program to begin, at least with student-athletes?
Yes, I think, you know, we definitely want our athletic teams to be known in Iowa for the good work they're doing. And so I think this is an opportunity for men and women within those teams to be presented as leaders leading other students in helping to transform our cultures to safer campuses to safer places to live.
How do you know this is working, Annette? Do you have concrete examples, feedback that you get that you know positively this program, these programs are having an effect, that there are role models, males stepping in to break up a potentially spiraling situation?
The statistics I'm going to talk about in terms of the MVP program, and I am going to draw from the Sioux City school system because at the same time I was implementing MVP at college level 10 years ago, MVP was also being implemented by the Waite Foundation in Sioux City. But in I'll give you kind of an analysis of their data. In 2008, comparative studies, students in the Sioux City Community School District were more likely to view peers' acts of violence as being wrong, more willing to take actions against violence when observed, and reported more adults in schools and parents talking about the issue than students who had not been trained. And so they have done systematic studies in Sioux City looking at schools, looking at students that had been trained in MVP, students that had not been trained. And it does move students to, first of all, see peer acts of violence as being wrong. And secondly, it does move those students to intervene, to try to do something. And then I think also importantly, it creates a culture in the schools where people are talking about the issue, it's not just the students talking about it, but the faculty and the staff. And I think that's one thing the flagship grant has been very good at doing across the campus system with the Board of Regents is prioritizing this issue, getting this issue out there as a key issue that all of us need to work on campus. And so it's faculty, staff, and students that all need to see this as a key area that we need to address and an important issue on our campuses.
Let's see if we can squeeze in a call or two before the end of the hour. Kryn is joining us from Dubuque. Thank you for waiting, Kryn. If I got your name right, I hope I did.
You did. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful program, and I commend you on doing this. I'm an OBGYN, and I just wanted to say that I think we need to encourage our providers and all parents to sit down when we're sending our kids off to school. And not only are we worried about getting their physical exam and their vaccinations, we need to sit down and talk with them about, with the new freedom come a lot more challenges at school. And so I always try to talk with my patients that I think all these things have been mentioned, to work out the buddy system, not to be going to parties without a friend, and work out a system or a code word or a time that you're going to check in with each other. And I talked to them about their alcohol use, that it can mean weakening of judgment. And young women, I always tell them to try to keep their drink with them if they're drinking, to mix their own drinks, not to have other people making them for them.
Are date rape drugs still a problem?
We still see some of this quite a bit, you know, or that they think they've mixed their drink mildly or not a lot of alcohol in it, and then somebody doubles or triples the amount and affects them differently. And again, then I always talk with them that no means no. Just because you were kissing someone doesn't mean that you're consented to have sex with them, that you repeat it, you holler, you scream, and you resist. So I just think that as parents and providers, we all need to remember that these are things that we need to talk with our patients and our children about.
Thank you, Kryn, joining us from Dubuque. The hour rapidly disappearing. Wanted to go to Monique quickly to follow up on that. Kryn's comment, this is part of a freshman's education now, coming to the all three Regents universities?
Correct. And at the University of Iowa, we're using an online course that all of our first-year students are asked to complete before coming to campus. It addresses some of the issues the caller just mentioned. It specifically talks about how to keep yourself safe and also raises awareness about not just sexual misconduct, but dating violence and stalking as well.
Carla Miller, you had something to add here before we have to go.
Yes. What I wanted to say is that I think it's wonderful that she talked about talking with our daughters about going to college. And I would just add to that the efforts to educate young men as well. Women, we can reduce the risk, but we really need to talk to young men as well about appropriate behavior.
Quickly, we haven't focused very much on the perpetrators here. Who are these assailants? What sort of myths need to be busted about these people?
Well, I think we somehow in our minds want to separate the fact that a student who goes here is also a repeat criminal or a criminal to begin with, when in fact we know that they are. We know that there are many sex offenders who have college degrees, who have gone to colleges, and we need to treat them as criminals as the way that they are, and not that it's just bad sex or boys will be boys, but focusing on the offender to be able to address this problem.
Annette Lynch, I want to give the final word to you as the flagship director of the Campus Violence Prevention Project for the region's universities. What's the way forward?
I think the way forward is to keep the issue front and center, which I think is easier when you have million-dollar grants. And our grant, the flagship grant, is ending this summer. I just ask all the campus communities and the people of Iowa to keep this issue at the very front. In terms of retaining students, in terms of students doing really well in their classes, it's very important that they live in a supportive environment. And so this is integral to the success of our students in Iowa, and that I think we all have a job, and that includes the parent that's sending the students off to school. It includes the high school teachers. It includes professors and administrators and staff at all the campuses. But it's really an issue that transcends the campus and goes into the communities, and everyone needs to take a role.
Dr. Annette Lynch, I want to thank you very much for you and I joining us this afternoon, professor and flagship director of the Campus Violence Prevention Project. Thank you, Annette.
You're welcome.
Also, thanks to Monique DiCarlo and Carla Miller joining us, executive director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Carla Miller and Monique DiCarlo, the newly created position of Sexual Misconduct Response Coordinator at the University of Iowa. Thank you two for joining us.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.